Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, Senior Clinician in Rabbit and Exotic Animal Medicine and Surgery at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, Jenna Richardson. Thank you, Jenna. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. So today we're going to have a recap on endocrine diseases in ferrets. And really we're going to consider three of the most common endocrine problems. Ferrets really are, very lovely, energetic pets. They're very rewarding and fun to own. I honestly think if it wasn't for their odour, they'd be a lot more commonly kept in the UK. Unfortunately, with ferrets, we do see endocrine-related conditions with some frequency, and they can be severely debilitating, and in some cases they can lead to death. So this webinar is aimed to provide a reminder regarding the most common endocrine disorders in the ferret. We'll review the three endocrine disease processes that are seen most commonly, so that's our adrenal gland disease, hyperestrogenism and insulinoma. And for each disease we'll consider the clinical signs, diagnostic tests, treatment options and the expected outcomes as well. So beginning with adrenal gland disease, this is particularly common in middle-aged ferrets, and certainly it's very well reported in the USA. And there's many great American veterinary textbooks that go into a lot of detail about adrenal gland disease. The true incidence of this in the UK has not been reported. However, a study at Utrecht University in the Netherlands found that the incidence of adrenal disease in the Dutch population of ferrets at 0.55%. So same with relative commonality there as well. Now, the most common adrenal gland disease is hyperadrenocorticism. However, it should be remembered that the clinical signs and the diagnostic tests differ from those in dogs, as the syndrome is dependent on specifically which part of the adrenal cortex that is affected. So logically, it makes sense that hyperfunction of the adrenal cortex will lead to clinical signs, depending on which layer, if you like, of the cortex is affected. So for hyperaldosteronism, also known as Kahn's syndrome, we see an increased production in mineralocorticoids, and that occurs from the zona glomerulosa. In Cushing's type syndrome, that's the zone of vesiculata that's affected, and we see this overproduction of glucocorticoids. And this is the one that we're most familiar with in our canine species. In ferrets, however, the most common is our hyperandrogenism. And so what we see there is we have an increased production of androgens because it's the zona reticularis layer of the adrenal gland that is affected. So in pet ferrets, hyperandrogenism is the most common for our hyperadrenocorticism. So what we see from this overstimulation is adrenocortical hyperplasia, and that can then go on to result in the development of neoplastic processes, the most common being adrenal adenoma or adrenal adenocarcinoma. While both adrenal glands can be affected, in a large-scale study in the US, 85% of cases were found to be unilateral disease with only one gland being affected. So when we're thinking about diagnosis by hormone assays, it is important to remember that an ACTH stim test is of little use, and instead what we should be aiming to test are our sex steroids, our androgen levels. So the three most useful that we're testing is androstenedione, estradiol and 17-hydroxyprogesterone. Now, nowadays, most of the commercial labs will do a ferret endocrine profile, which will automatically include these three levels. So it is speculated, certainly, that early neutering and adrenal gland disease are related. And this has been shown as well in some strains of mice when they've had undergone early castration. And there are some very notable differences in husbandry between the US and with Europe. And that is that in the US, a good proportion of the American pet ferret population are neutered at a very young age, so as young as 6 weeks of age. And the fact that disease seems to be more prevalent in the US, I mean, we could think that loosely that could be related. It could also be they're more commonly seen as pets as well and kept as pets. However, if we put a little bit of science behind these things, then what we're seeing with our neutered ferrets is that we get this metaplasia of undifferentiated gonadal cells that are present in the adrenal capsule. And that occurs once the gonads have been removed. And once the gonads are removed, these cells then become functional. And so we see them starting to produce. And it's certainly accepted, I think, in the literature and certainly in the vet population over here, that neutering, regardless of age, once it's performed, ferrets are seen to be at an increased risk of developing adrenal gland disease. Interestingly, there is no sex predilection with this, so both males and females appear to be equally affected or unaffected. So, why specifically does adrenal gland hyperstimulation occur with neutering? Well, this slide, hopefully, I can explain it well enough, but it's a little bit complicated. So if we think that the gonads naturally have a negative feedback effect on the hypothalamus, so for entire animals we've got this negative feedback on the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus normally produces your gonadotropin-releasing hormone, so your GnRH. So if you take away the gonads, either the testicles or the ovaries, it doesn't matter the sex, then that negative feedback is lost. So what we have is the hypothalamus just continues to produce GnRH with no negative feedback on it. So when you have GnRH, it is acting upon the luteinizing hormones, the LH receptors, which are present in the adrenal cortex, and the GnRH stimulates these LH receptors. So if you're producing lots of GnRH, it's thought that this overstimulation of the LH receptors can lead to this adrenal hyperplasia, which then predisposes to further development and differentiation to neoplasia. And that's when we see our adrenal adenomas and adenocarcinomas developing. So again, just to reconfirm the fact that in ferrets we're looking at this hyperandrogenism rather than anything related to cortisol that we see more commonly in our other species. So clinical signs, therefore, are related to hyperandrogenism. So they're related to this overproduction of sex steroids. And a very, very common presenting sign, and something that if you're seeing a ferret coming in with areas of alopecia in practice, adrenal gland disease got to be high up there on your differential list. So over 90% of affected individuals are reported to have some level of hair loss. And this can be, as you can see from the photos, the bottom one, very dramatic in appearance, where they can be almost completely bald. Also, when you're examining, the hair is very easy to epilate, so it comes out very well from its hair follicles. It's easy to remove. In the females, as you can see from the picture at the top right, vulval swelling. In neutered females, so it doesn't have to be, entire, which would be more suggestive of hyperestrogenism, but vulval swelling in neutered females, plus or minus a discharge can be seen. In males, we can see dysuria, And that's secondary to a prostatic hyperplasia that they can get. And obviously, if we've got enlargement of the prostate, we can then result in either a partial or, in extreme cases, a full urethral obstruction. And that can obviously then lead to renal disease as well. In some cases, we can see pruritus in affected individuals. Most commonly around the area of the shoulder blades, and we can see erythema in these areas as well. And it's speculated about 30% of affected ferrets have pruritus as a clinical sign. Now, because the ferret is very long and thin, it does mean that abdominal palpation is often quite rewarding. And because we've got quite a shallow depth between the spine and the entry to the abdomen, palpation of adrenal glands is theoretically possible. The left adrenal gland is easier to palpate than the right, and that's simply because the right is more cranial in position, and it tends to be positioned also under the caudate lobe of the liver as well. So when I'm trying to identify adrenal glands, I first identify my kidneys, and then I almost walk my fingers forward to the cranial pole of the kidney and palpate around the area of where the adrenals would be expected to be. So in extreme cases, we can certainly feel adrenal gland enlargement on palpation. So diagnosis can certainly presumptively be made from clinical signs. However, ideally we want to visualise the adrenal glands and obtain some measurements to see how true our enlargement is. Now, direct visualisation is obviously a very invasive way of going about this, so ultrasonography is very useful. Now, ferrets are usually amenable to conscious ultrasound examinations. If you have one who's particularly fractious, a little bit of sedation could assist. But usually with sensible restraint, they will allow. Remembering that obviously clipping over the ventral abdomen, try and warm as much as possible the room, the ultrasound gel, just to make sure that your patient isn't going to cool down too much. And for reference, I always, when I'm looking for these things, look for kidneys first. They're very easy to identify, and then I work to the cranial pole for identifying the adrenal glands. So what I've quoted you here is just from the BSAVA rodent and ferret manual, and it's just some normal adrenal gland sizes. Now, there is a bit of a variation to these. And certainly there does seem to be variation depending on the weight of the animal and also the sex as well. But generally comparing one to the other, the right gland usually is a little bit bigger than the left, but the two are fairly comparable. So we can see the reported ranges here. The left gland length up to a centimetre. Width anywhere from 3 to almost 5 millimetres, and depth 2 to about 4 millimetres. And then the right gland, so a little bit larger in length, 7.5 up to 12.7 millimetres. So these are quite useful just to have as reference points, and obviously you can, on most ultrasound machines now, take a static image and then figure out your length with the tools on your ultrasound machine. So as well as ultrasound, we can take a blood sample to check for our plasma sex steroid levels. And remembering that the normal test used for diagnosing Cushing's, for example, with our ACTH stimulation test, dexamethasone suppression test, they are not of use in our ferret patients. So just a little bit of reference for you here in terms of what is normal and what is sort of considered diseased of a particular case that we had. So the reference ranges here, they're just quoted from, I think these are from Carpenters, which is the exotic animal formulary. We're a bit spoiled for choice now because we've got both Carpenters and PSAV that have produced very good quality and useful formularies, and they have normal blood values for many species, including our ferrets. So you can see that our androstenedione, 0 to 15 nanomoles per litre, is normal. Estradiol, 30 to 80, that's micromoles per litre. And then our 17-hydroxyprogesterone, not to 0.8 nanomoles per litre as well. So certainly these are things that are readily able to be tested for. In terms of blood sample sites, so jugular is always a good option in our ferrets. For smaller amounts, cephalic can be useful, and lateral saphenous. Ferrets are usually quite wriggly, so you would need a compliant one to be doing that conscious. The use of anaesthetic topical cream, Emla cream, for example, usually means they don't react as much to the needle, but often a short anaesthetic is required to facilitate blood sampling. So how do we treat this condition? Well, historically, surgery was always the answer, with adrenalectomy being the treatment of choice. And studies from the US documented that 64% of cases required removal of the left adrenal gland, 26% from the right, and in 8% they removed both. Removing both, however, it should be remembered that there is an increased risk of inducing an Addisonian crisis. So very close post-operative monitoring is required for any form of adrenalectomy. Complications that these surgeries documented included hyperglycemias, hypothermias, inducing anemia either through blood loss at surgery, renal failure, heart failure. These were all things that were later documented, and obviously with kidney and heart failure, that is likely to have contributed to their perioperative death records. So, I mean, we don't actually really promote surgical treatment anymore. We tend to opt for a medical management. However, there are times when it may still be appropriate. So I thought I would just discuss some surgical principles for ferrets that will also be useful when we consider insulinoma in a little bit. So hypothermia is a very big problem for our smaller patients, and our ferrets are no exception. So our clip should be large enough, our fur clip should be large enough to allow for an exploratory laparotomy, which is often the amount of access that you're going to require for this procedure. However, we have to remember, while a big clip is perhaps necessary, to reduce heat loss, spirit and cleaning fluid should be warmed prior to use. The surgical suite, the room, should be warmed as well. We should have a heated table. Fluids that are being administered IV should be preheated. And ideally, the bear hugger should be used for positioning the ferret on as well. So remember as well, all tissues should be very gently handled, and good hemostasis is key, because blood loss in such small little creatures can become significant rather quickly. So things we like to use here at the University of Edinburgh in the rabbit and exotic animal department. So transparent drapes can be very useful, allows you to see your patient, make sure chest movements are going accordingly, which is not so much a consideration for you as a surgeon, but for your nurse monitor and anaesthetic, it's always handy to be able to see the patient. And these are commercially available. Also thinking about what size of surgical kit. So often what you're using for dog is going to be a little bit bulky. So making sure you've got some daintier equipment that doesn't complicate your surgery unnecessarily. We use a lot of sterile cotton buds, very handy for moving bits of bowel out of the way, for suppressing or putting pressure on, rather, to help with controlling any hemorrhage. So very useful for sterile cotton buds. And then these surgical clips are also extremely useful, particularly for a surgery which would be removing something positioned close to the vena cava. So here you can see that we've got my little arrow here. So this has a sticky back to it, so you can actually stick it to a drape or even the back of your glove. And the instrument just scoops up one of the LIGA clips, and then it's just closed, and we get this very nice seal, which can be very useful in areas where it's difficult to place ligatures with suture material. Cautery is also very useful, so just because it's a small animal, it's still very much worthwhile getting the cautery set up. We want to minimise any blood loss, so monopolar or bipolar cautery is useful. And then appropriate suture selection. So to minimise the risk of tissue reaction, a monofilament synthetic material is best for intra-abdominal use. Monacryl, for example, is a good choice for internal sutures. It does have more memory and less knot security than multifilament, so it's important that the sutures are placed carefully and the knots are tightened well. PDS lasts for a longer time period, so that's always used for the body wall, for the muscle closure. We don't advise the use of catgut sutures. I know it can still be fairly commonly used in general practice, but we tend to see the complications of this suture material, with patients often being referred to us for resection surgeries following suture material reaction. So as there are safer alternate options available, it'd be more sensible to pick those. And then tissue glue as well can be useful just for helping to hide sort of ends of wounds that might not have closed as well as you wanted during intradermal closure. So you can see here just the tip of the glue with a little bit of tissue glue going onto a wound. So a couple of things to consider for adrenal disease for surgery. Often you need a sizable midline opening in order to have good exposure. Theoretically, it's possible to perform this with laparoscopy, and it's certainly used in dogs. However, I don't believe it's been reported in ferrets yet, but the technique would be the same. As we saw from one study, 85% of adrenal gland disease in ferrets is unilateral. And certainly from a surgical complication point of view, the left adrenal gland is much easier to remove than the right. So often, historically, when there was bilateral disease, vets would remove the left adrenal gland and either treat medically the right or debulk the right but not completely remove. And we are stepping away from the surgery now. We're definitely moving towards medical management. And that's because we've got this supraluran implant now available, which we'll come to in a little minute. But I just wanted to show you a couple of pictures, not my own ones, these are borrowed, but from time of surgery. So just point out a couple of things, get my little marker. So I've got stomach up here. This is the left adrenal gland. We've got vena cava here. And what we can see, and this is often something that with the use of ultrasound, you'll be able to determine whether or not we think we can safely remove an adrenal tumour, depending on how much periglandular fat is present. So here you can see quite a lot of periglandular fat, which means that there's this room to come in with our LIGA clips, using our cotton buds as well to gently put pressure, moving the tumour away from the vena cava, and just ligating along using the surgiclips and just sharp dissection on this side for removal of the tumour. With the right side, so the right adrenal gland is more closely associated with the caudal vena cava, and so we do tend to see more commonly invasion of the vena cava with the right adrenal tumours. And certainly the tumours, both right and left, can grow significantly in size. The right side is more tricky for surgery, for access, because not only is it positioned more cranially, but it's also under the caudate lobe of the liver as well. So for medical treatment, So for medical treatment, as we said, the sort of in-fashion treatment is the GnRH agonist, so the implant desrolelin, which the trade name is supraleurin. So this blocks sex steroidogenesis due to having these sustained high levels. So it's not having a pulsatile effect, we're having this nice high level just being persistent and consistent. So we do find, however, that the implant has the opposite effect to the desired one for the first 2 weeks. It does seem to stimulate things more. However, after that, it does suppress the production of GnRH from the hypothalamus. And how do we know it's working? Well, we start to get resolution of these clinical signs. So that can include the vulval swelling disappearing within 1 to 2 weeks. We get hair regrowth, and that's usually by 1 to 2 months. It can take up to 5 months before we get complete resolution of the hair coat, but nonetheless, that's something we can expect to see. One important point, however, is that no matter what medical treatment that we employ, it doesn't seem to make much difference to the actual size of the adrenal tumour. At best, we can hope that it's not going to increase further in size, but we aren't going to shrink it either. Leuprolide acetate is also one that's documented as a treatment, and there's different dose rates that's written in the different formularies. So one is 100 micrograms per kilogram by subcutaneous injection, and that's given every 21 to 30 days, depending on clinical response. Usually after the third injection, we've got a full clinical response, and remission is often documented at 6 months. There are some reports of just 2 mg being given per ferret, which is not as exact as it could be, thinking that it lasts for about 4 months. And the supraleurin, the desrolelin implant, as we said, the sort of current treatment of choice, the 4.7 milligram. There is a higher strength one as well. Now, in terms of how long that works for, again, there's variation here in that sometimes it's a year, it can be as much as 2 years. So this is a temporary solution that requires repeat applications. And you can see this photo on the bottom right of the implant being applied between the shoulder blades of a ferret. I very, very rarely anaesthetise ferrets for this. Usually I find having a nurse restrain with just a hand over the neck, kind of cuffing it, and a hand over the pelvis, again, sort of almost cuffing with downward pressure, tends to help. Just hold them nice and steady. You can do food distractions. It is a big needle, like a microchip-sized needle, and with hobs, so mature males, they often have quite tough skin at the back of the neck as well. So I prepare owners that we may need to anaesthetise, but if I can place it conscious, usually I do that. So from all of that information, to neuter or not to neuter our ferrets, well, Just to hit home the message of rabbits, yes, we want to neuter male and female rabbits for a variety of reasons. But our current thinking for ferrets in the UK, and at least at the establishment that I work at, is that no for both males and females. So while rabbits, it's a given, we always promote neutering of that species. For ferrets, we say no. And so instead, what we've got to think about is, well, why would we be neutering? We'd be neutering to prevent reproduction. So what are the alternatives that we can offer to owners? Well, we can use the Supralorin implant. So this reduces the release of our follicular stimulating hormones as well as our luteinizing hormones, and it desensitizes the GnRH receptors. As I said, it can last anywhere from a year to 2 years, so it does require replacing. We do find it can be used for males as well, so it's not just a case of for females to prevent hyperestrogenism. So what we typically see is after 2 weeks, we get this cessation of reproductive behavior. Remember, we get this overstimulation for the first 2 weeks. In males, the testicles will shrink in size, and they become sterile after 4 weeks, but it is reversible. Another alternative is the Gil jab, as it's well known as, which is delvosterone, and that can be given as an injection at the start of each mating season for Gil. So we recommend that to be in February, and that is a one that prevents a persistent oestrus for that particular season. But again, it's a temporary solution that requires repeat injections. And we can mate, apologising for the typo there on mating, but we can mate with a vasectomised hob for entire females. And again, as induced ovulators, that will stop them from going into persistent oestrus without having a viable mating and resulting in unwanted pregnancy. Corulon is also something that has been used in the past. And it can be used, but when there's better alternatives, that's why I've not sort of included that. So what can we say about adrenal disease before we move on to our other two? Well, it's complex. It certainly seems as though neutering can cause and lead to adrenal disease development. Our GnRH implants are now the sort of gold standard of medical treatment. What we're aiming to do is to manage the clinical signs, but it should be remembered that once an adrenal tumour develops, it cannot regress just with medical therapy. So if you have an owner that is adamant that they want their ferret to be neutered, you need to have a frank discussion with them about the real risks of developing adrenal disease and what that can mean to the ferret. And if you do neuter, we recommend then placing at the same time a GnRH implant. What you want to do is prevent adrenal tumours from developing. So, some people will say, well, we'll neuter, and once they start showing adrenal disease, then we'll place the implant. Well, at that point, disease is already present, and we're then on a management only. So, you're better to prevent, and if an owner is adamant on neutering, then also place an implant would be the advice. So moving on now to our next topic, which is reproductive endocrinology. So just thinking about ferrets in general, so when day length exceeds 12 hours, reproductive activity is promoted. So if we think about ferrets kept indoors, the photophase of their day is artificially increased. So what we can see is that gills can, and a gill being a female ferret, can already be in heat as soon as February, for these reasons. But traditionally, the breeding season is considered to be March to September. So an important point regarding gills is that they are induced ovulators, which mean they need the stimulation of mating to ovulate. And it's not just the act of mating. They require the stimulation of the sort of precursor, the neck biting, being dragged by the hob, as well as the act of mating as well. And hyperestrogenism is a disease of entire females, but it should be remembered that females with ovarian remnants can also be affected. So if you have a neutered female and you don't think the presenting signs are consistent with adrenal gland disease, do think ovarian remnant as a differential diagnosis. So why is it a problem? Well, when ovulation doesn't occur, so when we have these induced ovulators where there's no stimulation to actually ovulate, this ovulation state results in estradiol levels elevating. And when we have high levels of estradiol, we can then see bone marrow suppression. And that can lead to anemia where we have low red blood cells, or it can lead to pancytopenia where we generally have low platelets, red blood cells, as well as white blood cells. And when we have low white blood cells, we can be more prone to infection because of this leukopenia. So what are our clinical signs? Well, we can get alopecia. Usually it's over the tail base and not as prolific as what we see in adrenal disease. The patients can be very weak, and that's because the females are severely anemic, and we can have weakness as a result. When we look at mucous membrane colours, both conjunctival as well as oral, we can see these very pale mucous membranes. The vulva is often swollen and ingested. Sometimes we have discharge associated. We can see systolic heart murmurs, petechiation on the skin. And we can also have posterior paresis as well. So important to work out, have we got a true weakness because of anemia, or have we got a paresis? So checking reflexes and limb withdrawals and deep pain of hind limbs. And then, of course, we can see secondary systemic infections. So, you know, you could be treating a respiratory tract infection that's very severe, but actually the reason for it is because we've got this persistent estrus with hyperestrogenism and estrogen toxicity. So our differential diagnosis, well, this photo here is of an adrenal disease ferret, but hyperestrogenism would be on your list because of the areas of alopecia. So we want to rule out adrenal gland disease. Seasonal alopecia we can see. So if your animal's clinically bright and well otherwise, but just a little bit of fur loss, then it could be just that we have some seasonal alopecia. And then primary bone marrow neoplastic processes as well. So how are we diagnosing these things? Well, it's very important that we take a full patient history. So we can see this photo here. Just remembering to not just skip important points, getting a full overview of how the animal is housed, how many there are, what the diet is, how much handling they get from the owner, and whether we deem that to be appropriate or not. Hematology, certainly to look at our red blood cell and white blood cell levels. And then if we're still not sure whether we've got adrenal disease, then an ultrasound of the abdomen to assess adrenal glands and look at adrenal size would be very useful. Our treatment is aimed at supportive care. Fluid therapy is very important. So you can see this little chap, she's got her cephalic IV catheter in her right leg. And as well as IV fluids, she's getting nutritional support. We obviously want to stop estrus, but we need to make sure that we're not forgetting about perhaps prophylactic antibiotics in cases where we've got very low white blood cells or signs of infection, supplements with vitamins, iron, and as we said, nutritional support is very important. In some cases, the animals can be so debilitated that we need to think about a blood transfusion. Now, in ferrets, typically if we see a PCV of below 15%, then we would go ahead and transfuse. We don't need to cross match, so we can go from a donor animal and obtain a sample. Now, I've got a photo coming up in a little bit that shows the size difference between a hob and a gill. Most ferret owners will have a hob or a gill together, or they'll have friends, ferret friends who have a suitable donor as well. So that's always worth asking when the owner comes in to you. For blood transfusion, this is what I follow for all of my small mammal exotic species. So you would want to do a full health check on your hob, make sure he's well enough, and then I would anaesthetise to obtain blood. Usually I do 2 5-mil syringes, aiming to collect 4.5 mils of blood per each jugular, with 0.5 mil of citrate, phosphate, dextrose, adenine, anticoagulant, quite a mouthful that, but CPDA, which if you were doing it in a 10 mil syringe, that would be 9 mils of blood to 1 mil of anticoagulant. And that's just reducing the risk of any clots developing. So once you've collected your sample, you want to have your IV access in your recipient. Connect up a T connector, just so you've got a bit more room to play with. And then we use these 18 micron blood filters. So I've put the name and the company up there. I'm sure others are available, but this is what I've had experience with myself. So we attach the filter to the T connector and then directly to the syringe containing the blood. Now this has four little chambers and little triangles like pieces of pie, and what you want to do is to carefully fill the filter with the blood. So you gently plunge and express some blood through into the filter. Once one little chamber fills, you turn it to its side and fill another, and it's with gravity. Once all four are filled, then the blood makes its way through that filter and to our patient. So you ideally want to transfuse at about 0.5 mils per kilo over the first 30 minutes, watching for any potential transfusion reaction. And you can either do that just injecting little and often, or if you have a syringe driver, which can be got from Human Medical Supplies, then you can set that up and use that. So here you can see an example of the top photo, just a 10 mil syringe being used to get a jugular sample in a ferret, in a hob. And then we can see the bottom where we've got our gill, who's the poorly one, and the hob, who is our healthy donor. And because of the size disparity, hobs are able to give 10 mils of blood readily without causing them any concerns, as long as they're bright and well in themselves. So what else do we want to do? Well, obviously we want to stop why the problem happened in the first place, which is cessation of estrus. So we can either use the gill jab, so the delvosterone, we can implant, or we can think about sterile mating. Now with the GnRH, that can take a little bit of time to have effect, and remember, it can actually worsen the situation first. Sterile mating isn't ideal in a patient that's debilitated, so often we go for the gill jab and supportive care. But remembering that prevention is much better, so medical neutering, having your female ferrets come in February of every year, making sure that they are clinically examined to be bright and well, and they have their preventative reproductive either implant or injection given. So what can we conclude from our hyperestrogenism? Well, prevention is definitely better than cure, better to avoid the drama and just have healthy animals. So whenever you see your ferret owners, whether it be health checks or just routine visits, we want to discuss how we're managing estrus in their entire gills. Certainly, going for routine medical neutering, but understanding, that it's not a one-off. So again, making sure owners are aware of that they don't appear year one and then disappear and never to be seen again. And also, with hyperestrogenism, it is a readily preventable condition. But if the worst does happen, then as long as the patient presents promptly to you, then usually you can get a good resolution. And certainly don't be afraid of doing blood transfusions if they're required, because once you've mastered the technique, then it's fairly straightforward. Okay, so last but not least, we're going to just finish up with a little recap on insulinoma. So this is a relatively common tumour seen in middle-aged ferrets. So the average age is sort of documented about 5 years old, but it can range anywhere from 2 up to 8 years and older. It is a tumour of the pancreas, specifically the endocrine pancreas. And that makes up less than 10% of the total of the organ. But obviously the endocrine pancreas is a very important contribution to the overall health of the animal. So within the endocrine pancreas, we've got these small islands of cells known as our islets of Langerhans. And it's within these islands that we have our alpha, beta, delta, and F cells. And it's the beta cells that are responsible for synthesizing the protein insulin. And the beta cells are found pretty much concentrated in the center of the islets, whereas you've got your alpha cells found around the outside, around the periphery. So insulin is normally produced by the beta cells in response to high blood glucose levels, and it acts in a variety of ways to reduce the blood glucose level back to within the normal range. So with insulinoma, what we see is that we have these beta cells that become neoplastic, and so they start to be overstimulated and overproduce insulin. And the feedback mechanism is ineffective, and the hyperglycemia effects of glucagon and cortisol are inhibited. And so what this means is that we basically result in hypoglycemia. So physical exam, just to go over a few important points of that, because when we've got hypoglycemia, the clinical presentation of the patient is going to be consistent with signs of being weak, of having low blood glucose levels. But when we're examining ferrets, I treat them like little cats, so my exam is very similar to what it would be for a cat, including the fact that they could seem very friendly and then randomly give you a little nip as well. So important to always remember that. But just a few special considerations of your ferret clinical exam. So always making particular attention to mucous membrane colour. As a species, they are quite prone to dental disease when they're a bit older with tartar build-up. We see ear mites and wax quite commonly. And when you're auscultating the thorax, remembering that the heart's positioned a little bit more caudally than in other species down at the sixth and eighth rib. Because we see lymphoma very commonly, remember palpation of the lymph nodes is important. We can see large spleens as they get older. And they do tend to resent temperature, so I tend not to do that with the owner there. I'll get a nurse to hold if I'm needing to take temperature, which is usually part of a regular clinical exam. So remembering our normal clinical exam technique, clinical signs of insulinoma are usually pretty distinct. Often the owner will report these sort of acute attacks where the animal is depressed, maybe in recumbency. They might be completely collapsed. We can see sometimes hypersalivation and a bit of this, they call it glassy-eyed appearance, where they're just not really that aware of what's going on. And sometimes the episodes resolve on their own, but usually they require intervention in the form of glucose or at least feeding. So how are we diagnosing these? Well, again, because the clinical signs are so specific, usually that's a very good indicator. But what we want to try and do is confirm that our blood glucose levels are remaining persistently low, particularly during attacks. So you can use your portable glucometers, but do remember that they often will typically underestimate blood glucose. So we sort of say that the cutoff is about 2.7 millimoles per litre for in-house testing. But if we've got nice accurate, then less than 3.3. But really, you know, if we're getting less than 4 on a regular scale, dropping down to 2 point somethings, then that's pretty conclusive. So what do we do if we've got a patient comes in as an emergency with these clinical signs? Well, first of all, if it's well enough, you feed the patient. Usually they're hungry, they want to eat, and then they sort of self-resolve just by actually taking on some food. If they're not well enough, then you may need to administer a bolus of dextrose solution. Tend to use 50% dextrose, diluted in a 1-to-1 with saline, giving between 1 to 2 mils over sort of 3 minutes IV to effect. But in an urgent situation, owner phoning at home, you can get them to put sugar on the gums just as you would in a diabetic dog that had been overdosed with insulin. Dexamethasone's also been reported to counteract the hypoglycemic effects, but certainly aiming towards sort of food management in the initial stage and administration of dextrose is important. If you have a patient that comes in crashed, once you've got them stabilised, you can put them on a drip, add in 5% dextrose supplemented to prevent a repeat situation. So here we've got just a little one being syringe fed. And in terms of our nutritional support, so of course you can use cat food. A lot of ferrets will be having that as their natural diet. But there are now a lot of nutritional support products available specifically for carnivorous species like the ferrets. So emmerade carnivore, oxbow carnivore, they can be very useful. If an owner has none of these things at home, you know, sugar water, as we said, even baby food. And in terms of your syringe feeding, remember that you can, as well as using little dinky syringes of 1 mil to get into the mouth, you can also use bigger 15 mil dosing syringes as well. So what's our medical therapy for insulinoma? Well, there's two sort of well documented. One is prednisolone and the other is diazoxide. Now, prednisolone tends to be more commonly used, not necessarily because it's the best, but because financially it's cheap as chips. Whereas diazoxide, certainly in the States, tends to get a lot more press behind it actually being effective. And often people will use that as first line, increasing dose rates from, they start at 5 mg per kg per os every 12 hours, that can go up to 15 to 20 mg per kg per os every 12 hours. And then if it's not working, prednisolone is added in at that point. Diazoxide inhibits insulin release. It certainly promotes gluconeogenesis and it does reduce peripheral uptake of glucose as well, making it more accessible. So I think from you know, an ideal treatment point of view, diazoxide should be your first line, but the cost is probably about 12-fold more per tablet than prednisolone, and that often affects an owner's decision making, plus the fact that you would have to buy in a particular tub for one animal because it's not likely to get a lot of use from other species. But in an ideal world, diazoxide would sort of predominate over prednisolone. There is also surgical treatment, and surgery is indicated either in young ferrets, where we're hoping to actually significantly increase life expectancy. We should remember that this is a palliative option, not a curative one. And recurrence is common. And we can even see recurrence fairly soon after surgery, as soon as 2 months and sometimes even sooner, up to 6 months of resolution. And surgery can involve either removing specific nodules or removing part of the pancreas. We can see metastatic disease, certainly common in dogs, slightly less common in ferrets, but nonetheless it is reported. And just remembering if we're going to surgery, not to fast your patient for too long beforehand, supplementing IV fluids with dextrose and monitoring blood glucose levels, both during the procedure and in recovery and the days that follow. So why is surgery an option? Well, it does allow for a more direct approach in that we can visualize the pancreas and remove any areas of suspicion. It is important that we palpate as well as just looking visually, because we do find that, especially in fat animals, it can be difficult to see the lesions. We may have to rely on feeling by touch. An ultrasound is frustratingly not of a huge amount of use when we've got diffuse disease. It can identify little nodules, but for diffuse disease, it's not the most helpful. And radiography is really of little to no use either. Histopathology of any samples taken at time of surgery is crucial. You want to know what you're dealing with. So I've got a few pictures coming up here of just time of surgery. So here, this bright red area here is a nodule on the pancreas. So obviously that's quite easy to see and easy to dissect and remove. Remembering to have a little revision of your anatomy prior to going ahead with surgery. So we've got the body of the pancreas where we've got the pancreatic ducts draining. Now, obviously, you can't remove that because there's important structures there. However, the left and the right limb can both be removed. So typically, you could remove left and right limb but perform nodulectomies on the body. So here we've got a little, can't remember what instrument this is, but a little scoop to basically take out a nodule from the body of the pancreas. And again, just another view, you can see different surgery where we've got another nodule visible. And then cases like this, where bit of a blurry one this, sorry for that, but we're using palpation where we've got just this area of fat where it's very difficult to work out exactly what's going on. So we're using palpation to feel for nodules and then blunt dissection just to basically remove the nodules. And while we're getting caught up in what's going on up in the area of the pancreas, don't forget you've got to look after the rest of your organs. With your X-laps, you're checking for metastatic disease, and lap pads are very useful for protecting organs while keeping them moist. But also be aware that you can cool your patient quite rapidly this way as well. And just a couple more pictures there of again more obvious nodules, and you can see these animals are these one this one particularly is thinner. There's not quite as much fat as in the previous one where we had to rely on palpation. So what are the surgical risks? Well, we can get intraoperative insulin release. We can get pancreatitis after manipulating the pancreas, and we can be very mindful of managing potential hypoglycemic episodes as well. So the prognosis, well, I mean, it can be fatal, this disease. It certainly reduces life expectancy, but we can often get some level of management either with medical treatment or combined medical and surgical treatment. It might be one that, cases that if owners are willing is referred to referral institutes to have initial workup and then sent home with medical management. But certainly it's not a case where you would just euthanize straight away. You want to be trying treatment as long as the animal obviously isn't too significantly debilitated. And certainly if they prevent in a hypoglycemic crisis, that's a situation that you can resolve in a similar manner to a dog that's been overdosed with insulin. So just to finish up, insulinoma, it can be a bit frustrating. We do see temporary alleviation of clinical signs with surgery. Medical management is certainly a varied response, but don't automatically reach for prednisolone. Consider diazoxide. One thing, the diagnosis is certainly straightforward with these cases, but sadly we are shortening life expectancy once the ferret has the condition. So thank you very much for listening, and hopefully that's given a good little overview of the three main endocrine diseases in ferrets.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Jenna for an excellent presentation today. The recording and certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.